Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, September 22nd, 2011. And just to quickly let you know what tonight's main science topic will be, I'm going to talk about the tortured Earth and look into some of the inner workings of the Earth, look into the inside of the Earth, and just talk about what is there, where did this come from, and more importantly, what formed this, what reformed it over the many, probably billions of years that the planet has been here. Looking at geological processes is a difficult thing to do. But one thing is very certain, that if you see a layer on top of another layer, well, then that indicates that that layer came after the layer below it. One would assume that that is always true. But in some cases, the Earth has layers on top of other layers that were formed earlier. So the question is, how did those form? What exactly happened in the formation process of the Earth to cause that type of situation? So at any rate, and then just looking at some of the formations on the surface of the Earth can give you a bit of a perspective of the size, the shape of things. So just going to be talking about the surface of the Earth and what we can tell from it, and hopefully derive a few concepts that would teach us about other planets, and also possibly dispel a few of the rumors going around universities these days in geology departments. First of all, a quick note, the new CD, within a few days I'll be announcing titles for that, and I know this has been, people have been waiting for that, but this is part of a release process that I go through with any type of release, and as I've said before, this is a process that allows the message to get to the public before we call them trolls, the old story of a troll, the tale that you cross a bridge, and underneath the bridge are trolls. They're kind of like monster-like characters that come out and gobble up the people that try to get across the bridge. But at any rate, in real life, that's true too. We have what we call trolls. Trolls are people that sit out there and await for the unsuspecting, or in my case, I'm always suspecting it, passerby to try and, we call them internet trolls. That's their job, is to sit and wait until some piece of news comes out, then jump on it, twist it, and distort it for public consumption. So at any rate, that will be coming shortly. Just a couple quick announcements before I'm going to go into the science topic here much sooner in the show than normal. This past week, NASA unveiled a new mega rocket design that is supposed to take us into the next phase of space exploration. And as I explained in my book, The Diamond Principle, and the undercurrents of that are certainly in my other work, that rockets will never take us anywhere. They were good for the initial, you know, get something up in space, but they're simply a white elephant. And so to see the politics of this, in fact, NASA wouldn't even attend its own release of its new rocket design. It turns out that congressional interests from Texas, Alabama, California, and other states have been pressuring NASA to come up with some new mega project, excuse me, so that NASA can, the NASA funding can go, and of course that funding goes to all of these states. There's a term called Congress proof, a term we coined way, way back when it became apparent that NASA set up a little, it was kind of like you wouldn't call it a bribe, but it's, you may as well call it a bribe. They spread their technology and their sources of technology all over the United States. And of course, that's when NASA had a big name and everybody thought they were golden, excuse the pun. But that's when NASA put all of its resource procurement all over the United States. And so everybody could say, gee, yeah, that little company down there makes something for NASA. And then, of course, that money came in, and the constituency got some employment, and it got a name for NASA all over the place, and it got that senator elected again. So there was a whole cycle of good stuff that happened here with the NASA program. Well, now things are not so popular, but those jobs are still out there. So what I've seen in the write-ups that go along with this, and this is in the major news media, so finally the major news media is catching up with the real story here, that NASA is just an employer, and they have to be there to maintain jobs. And so everybody knows that this new mega rocket will never fly. NASA couldn't even get the next medium stage rockets off the ground. They had vibration problems, and they had all kinds of other problems. So how are they going to build a giant rocket? But see, this is the boondoggle part of it, that if they make a project so big and so extensive that nobody working on it now has to really accomplish anything, but they still get the money, that's the ticket. So at any rate, in fact, one of the congressmen reviewing the proposal said exactly that. He said, this thing will never fly. It'll pass Congress. They'll get the money. And NASA plans to spend $3 billion a year on this boondoggle rocket. Supposedly the biggest, they're billing it as the biggest rocket ever. But when you look at the payload, it's much smaller than the Saturn V rockets that were in fact built and were in fact very good working rocket models, which NASA totally destroyed. Why did NASA destroy those? Well, the real story is they don't want anybody going into space. We lived with the space shuttle for a long time, and that was a completely useless low Earth orbit facility that really ended exactly where it should have ended in the beginning, in the bit bucket. So at any rate, just a quick quirk on that. I've changed NASA's name from NASA to NISA, N-I-S-A, Nothing in Space Agency. As that's the story right now. They have nothing in space, no ability to go in space, and no real plans, no viable plans to go there. Just a quick note, this past week, more and more, I did a radio show on Coast to Coast one night. I called it The Myth of Alternative Energy, and I talked about the boondoggle of wind farms and other forms of alternative energy, how they in no way, shape, or form are going to solve our energy problem. And what it would really take, I pointed out on that show, just as a easy number for everybody to remember, you see these big, large wind towers that are being placed all over the state. South Dakota and Iowa have hundreds and thousands of them just lined up. And so the question is, how many of these wind towers would it take to really produce enough energy to make a difference on the worldwide scale, on the energy scale that we need to green up our energy, so to speak? It would take 77 million such towers working at their rated capacity, not their rated capacity, their actual capacity, which is about 20% of their rated capacity. But the point is, it would take around 77 million of those to replace our energy needs. And of course, the energy just to produce 77 million such towers is mind-boggling, and to install them and maintain them. But this past week, more the common scenario now is that the energy companies cannot afford to put these in. They're too expensive. They don't have a payback period, but they can get government incentives. And these government incentives kick money directly back into the hands of the companies that are producing these and installing them. So it's a way for revenue and work to happen, but these installations really don't produce a significant amount of energy. And so if you look at any of these fields, you'll see those three-blade systems sitting out there and hardly spinning, not producing much energy at all. And then there's the other point is that when it's determined through just experience and upkeep that these are no longer viable. There's nobody set up, there's no zoning, or there's no requirement for anybody to take these things down. I don't know what you can do with wind towers. They really don't fit nicely. You can't build another building with them. You really can't do much at all with them. They're just kind of there. So at any rate, the point is that governments are paying for these at taxpayers' expense, believing it's going to be a good thing, and everybody's out there thinking this is a great deal. But the reality is, number one, they're not going to produce the energy. Number two, the money is going to be spent and on the taxpayer bill, and the taxpayer paying long into the future without getting any benefit from this. And number three, when all of this folds down the line someplace, no one will be there to take these monstrosity ecological disasters down. Now, this is an interesting story, and I know it's being covered other places, but I want to give you my particular twist on it, because as soon as the Fukushima nuclear reactor incident occurred and the tsunami in Japan, I was probably the first person on the street running saying that this was not a natural earthquake, and with following tsunami, that this was a setup, that there were nuclear bombs placed in those trenches, and it's hard to say how long those were actually placed, had been in place waiting for such an incident. But then comes the Virginia earthquake, and followed by a Colorado earthquake, I believe the day afterwards. And these, of course, had absolutely the signature of nuclear bomb explosions underground. Of course, what's going on is somebody blew these up. But now what is surfacing, and I tend to agree with it, although I don't have direct information, is that there is a war going on amongst the highest people on this planet. And there's some people who are finally saying enough is enough. And what it appears, just from the location, not judging from anything else, that the bombs were placed in the underground cave cities of the U.S. military. And of course, these are coordinated with other groups, let's put it that way, who run the U.S. government. So now let's take a look at what happened. Japan has a nuclear disaster based on an earthquake, an alleged earthquake, which sends a tsunami, an artificial tsunami, in and destroys much of Japan. This gives them the excuse to blow up the Fukushima reactor, putting large amounts of nuclear waste into the environment, something that is still going on. That was March 11th. Now we fast forward to August 23rd and 24th. I think those are the dates of the Virginia earthquake and the Colorado earthquake. So a number of months later, I might add that it's very clear who would have had the incentive to blow up nuclear bombs and cause this kind of devastation in Japan. The end result of that is somebody is doing a eye for an eye, so to speak, and blowing up the underground bases, much of which is then dedicated to the U.S. hierarchy, the people that behind the scenes run the United States. I'm not talking about Obama. I don't think he's been invited or has a ticket, and probably the Bushes have not either. But it's hard to say. I won't guess as to who has tickets to the underground city. I know I didn't get mine in the mail. I don't believe most people listening to this show got theirs in the mail. But we know that they're there. We know that high-level people, many of whom you don't even know who they are, have their places set, complete with food and rations for possibly as much as 10 or 20 years down there. But the bombs going off, and then also military base, military activity underground, must have done a lot of damage, but more than doing just physical damage, it did a lot of damage to the infrastructure of intelligence. how could anybody get into these under bases and set off a nuclear device? Where did the nuclear device come from? But just from the location of the bombs under Virginia and under Colorado, we know those are U.S. military. And when I say U.S. military, they're not for the defense of the United States. These are for the protection of the international banking community and the associations which, let's say, are supported by those organizations, and a part of which is, you would say, instrumental in 9/11, the 9/11 event. It's a long chain of events. But anyway, my comment is that without knowing who did this, without really knowing where a bomb came from or who may have been able to pull this off, all I can say is that just given the location, Virginia and Colorado, that these are very, and also the fact that these were in fact nuclear bombs set off underground, these were not earthquakes, not natural events, it's very clear that someone is taking the international money brokers to the cleaners, and these people have no place to run once their underground cities become vulnerable. So this, actually, for the people out there who listen to this show, the people out there who are trying to make heads and tails out of this crazy world we live in, all I can say is this is a good thing from my perspective. But this could only lead to more retaliation, and where this is all going to end up, all the people living up here, just the normal people, are pawns in this vast resource-grabbing event that we've been seeing. I saw one statistic recently. The U.S. military uses 90% of the world's resources. Excuse me. So that's a very startling statistic, given the fact that world resources are being depleted at an incredible rate. Another little twist to this is that U.S. diplomacy is running into all of the contradictions that have been set up over the decades, the many, many decades of bad diplomacy, and the CIA trying to run little backstabbing wars and set up governments around the world, etc. All of this is coming home to roost, and nobody really is feeling sorry for the United States. About 60 countries have an alliance right now against the United States. So as people think that the next election is going to somehow solve their problems or the economic woes at home, they have another thought coming, because the rest of the countries collectively have a lot of power, and they simply don't want to play cards with the U.S. anymore. Just one second. I'm going to take a drink of water. I will be right back. Thank you. Okay, so with that in mind, all I can say is that in the upcoming months, it used to be that the people who ran the world, the New World Order, could pretty much pull the strings and move and shake as they wished. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore, and I think these people are going to be very nervous, because we know that they're the nameless people. But it's very clear that, at least at an intermediate level, their infrastructure has been shattered. And I would almost tend to believe that this could somehow be a setup, but I don't see it as that. I've tried to analyze that from about five different ways of looking at this, that this could be a setup, that it could be just a false flag where people think that there's something happening to them and it really isn't. But then given that once again, the bombs were nuclear bombs underground, there's no question about that. These were not natural earthquakes. Given the location in Virginia and in Colorado, someone, it is very clear to me, and I don't have direct evidence, but as a scientist, you add one and one together and you get two, and it's very clear that someone brought in and was able to get nuclear bombs into these facilities and blow them to smithereens. That's all I can say. And these were not being used for the defense of the United States, as you know, the money that and the time and effort that went into building these and the uses that they would be put to and by the people that were in charge of this and the people that were used to build this, well, all I can say is that it's turned their plans upside down. So all I can say is that the future is going to be very interesting, and I do feel the effects of much of this in my life as a scientist, because just things like the misinformation crew out there pounding the Comet-Elenin issue, that there was a non-issue, but clearly somebody was using those dates to try and use that as cover stories. So, and then I had to spend a lot of time out of my busy schedule trying to talk to the public about this, just as I spent a lot of time, if you listen to my shows leading up to 2003, May 15th, when supposedly Crazy Lady Talks to Aliens, Planet X was supposed to come up and crash into Earth and kill everybody. If you listen to my shows before then, it took me a lot of time to direct the public that these were false issues being raised, and that do not believe them, do not follow any information that you hear. But this shows you the level of misinformation. And then once again, you look at one of the top reasons why these cave cities were built was to protect the elite from a Planet X type of passage, so that they would have a safe haven at all of your expense, would take the resources of everybody else to protect them and leave you up here to fry. That's the kind of people if they are people at all, that's the type of mindset that they have. So, but once again, the cave cities, one of the major reasons they're there is to protect the elite against a incoming earthbound Planet X type of object. So at any rate, that certainly has affected my life as a scientist, because much of the things I do try to straighten this out and direct the public with what's going on in regard to Planet X, the fact that it'll look like a large comet. Look at all the misinformation that is out there regarding Planet X and the poor people out there trying to make heads and tails out of this. Look at the amount of effort. And so, as I've said before, you can take the international wars, you can take the war on terrorism, the old Cold War, you can take all of these and put them in one pile, and they don't hold a candle to the issue of Planet X. And the reason is because all of the petty wars, all of the other issues, even a limited nuclear war or whatever, would not hold a candle to a large Planet X type of encounter on planet Earth. So the point is that these people know that, but the one thing they also know is that every person on Earth would turn their heads away from the authority and control of these jokers if they in fact knew the real story. So as I said, this very much affects my life, because much of my scientific discussions revolve around the fact that Planet X, there are many of them, there are many out there. The fact that NASA does have programs, search programs, to find out this information, but they're not going to give it to you, it's to go to the boys on top. So now I'm going to turn to the main science topic tonight, the tortured Earth. And I've spent some time over the last few weeks looking directly at the Earth myself. And you know, these are studies that I do because they're part of my ongoing studies. And every now and then they produce a major result, which I release to the public in an organized form. But tonight I just want to talk a little bit about the tortured Earth. I started the show by talking about the fact that layers and layers and layers. Let's just talk about the mountains that are surround the Earth. If you look at, say, the Matterhorn, or you look at the peaks in the American Rockies, the Canadian Rockies, or you go down through Mexico, the Cordillera, Central Cordillera of Sierra that runs through Mexico, down through Central America, much of that volcanic. Whereas you get up into the Rockies, the volcanism kind of ends at the southern tip of the Rockies, and all of a sudden you start with what are known as the upthrust mountain systems. The volcanic mountain systems of Central and South America are different, and then you get down into northern South America, the countries that start around where Panama bridges into the South American continent, and you run down the western part of South America, many ranges of mountains there, many epochs of mountain building, but the majority of these, once again, upthrust mountains. So if you went to the university today to study geology, or if you studied planetary science, or if you studied astronomy, or if you went to pretty much any science program, you might go to a geology course, and it would try to talk to you. They would try and teach you something called plate tectonics. This is the concept that plates migrate around the world. Some of them fold underneath other continents, and other continents ride continental plates ride up over those. And they can certainly draw nice pictures. It's very convincing. It's very believable if you're not a physicist. If you're a physicist and you start asking questions like, gee, where do the forces come from that push continents sideways around the Earth? And, of course, there is no answer. It's just like, for example, what was a Physics Today, I believe, a year or two ago, and I know I talked about this on one of my radio shows, there was a physicist from MIT, a very respectable university, and he talked about the physics of hurricanes and how these were like a Carnot heat engine. How the hot air came in and rose up, and then the cooler air came up the eye of the hurricane and spilled out over the sides and cooled into the clouds, and this was like a Carnot engine. But there's one little fact that he forgot to mention, forgot to calculate. It all looked very good. The only problem is that the heat source for this hurricane, what they attribute it to is the warm water in the ocean. And if you look at a hurricane that passes over the ocean, there is a slight cooling of the ocean. Is that enough energy to drive a hurricane? And the fact is that it's off by a factor of about 20 to 100 million. Not just a little kind of error at the couple percentage factors at the end of an equation. We're talking off by so much that you can't even begin to imagine it. But yet you have a professor at MIT talking about the physics of hurricanes, but not including the most important factor that any physics problem should contain. That's called energy balance. Energy balance. Where does the energy come from? Where does it move through the system? And where does it go after the system is after this, in the process of working this system? Another little point on a hurricane. There's a very low pressure cell. We all know this. You can measure it. You can look at the statistics. You can look at a real hurricane, and they always talk about the low pressure at the center of the hurricane. And then the question arises, well, how does this low pressure, kind of like a vacuum, a mini vacuum, how is that sustained at the center of a hurricane when you have winds rushing into there at about 150 miles per hour? Now, gee, that wouldn't last too long. If you turn on your vacuum at home, it works on a similar principle, but you have something called an electric motor that runs your vacuum, and it sucks up all of the dirt and dog hair and whatever else is in your carpeting. and it brings it into the inner chamber in the vacuum. So, but a hurricane is very much like that, but you have to ask the question, where's the energy source to keep that low pressure cell, that vacuum, going? It's like if you turn the switch off on your vacuum cleaner at home, do you think it's going to keep running and running and running and sucking up dirt and dog hair from your carpeting? Let me see if anybody out there raises their hand and says yes. I'm waiting. I haven't heard any yeses yet. This is common sense. This is kindergarten common sense. Yet you have a PhD scientist at MIT talking around this problem and forgetting the main point. Something that I was taught, at least in freshman college physics, that you do your physics problem, you get all done, and the one thing you always do is an energy balance equation. You have to know where the energy came from, you have to know where it moved through the process, and then at the end you have to account for all the energy, some of it wasted, some of it turned into sound energy, some of it went into different types of energy, but you have to know where it came from, how it moved through the system, and where you have to account for all the energy after the process is finished. And if you have an ongoing process, like a tornado or a hurricane, you have to account for the energy as it is ongoing, as it is building. This is the energy equation. You have an MIT professor in meteorology who just kind of forgot that little step. So the point is that warm water could not possibly drive hurricanes. But on the evening news, on the Weather Channel, every place you look, if you go to meteorology school, if you go to any type of schooling, you will learn that warm water produces hurricanes. But it couldn't possibly be true. It's like the car moving down the street, and somebody looks at it, and somebody says, "Hey, what makes that car go?" And the guy looks at it, and he's never seen a car before, and there's exhaust coming out the exhaust pipe, and goes, "Well, gee, it must be that exhaust coming out the tailpipe is pushing, and that makes the car go." And so, oh, okay, that's the visible part of it. But if you did an energy calculation, and you went up to the exhaust pipe of a car, and said, "Well, you know, this is a 4,000-pound car, and there's not enough gas coming out of here to push a baby buggy down the street. Something's wrong here, folks." You know, that's where the energy calculation comes in. I'm just giving you a couple other examples. So what about plate tectonics? Okay, that's something every grade school student learns. You learn that there was continents that they put all the continents of the world together into one supercontinent, then it broke apart. And these moved around the planet, and now we have all the continents to see today, and gee, it just looks, in a textbook, looks pretty good to me. The only problem is, where did the forces come to push the continents around? These things don't just happen by themselves. Plates, continental plates, they're heavy, they're massive, and they have properties. And so let's look at another little property of plate tectonics that makes it hard to believe. Okay, now let's go across the Great Plains area of, well, let's take North America, or let's take Central Africa. Let's take a look at the vast plates. These are relatively soft material, and they're relatively deep. There's the crust and there's the mantle. But the question is, as these plates supposedly move around the globe, now you have the edge of the plates supposedly rising up, one plate rising up to thousands of feet. Now let's look at the highest peaks in the Himalayas, in the Rocky Mountains, in the upthrust mountains of the Andes. Let's look at those, and what do we find? Well, we find layers and layers and layers that, first of all, took millions and millions of years to form, and these form the very highest peaks of these upthrust mountain systems. In other words, the rock that you see in the highest peaks was tens of thousands of feet under the ocean at one time, and it's all smashed and twisted and pushed up. Is that the end result of plate tectonics, where plates simply moved along, one came up over the other? You'll see ridges coming from different directions. Some are pushed vertically upwards. I was just a couple months ago at an island, and I won't say exactly where it was, but it was an upthrust island. And you look at it, and it's long veins. The island is a series of long veins. And when you look at it closely, especially from aerial geological photos, you see that the entire island is the layers of the earth thrust vertically upwards. And it comes out of a shelf on the seafloor that is very deep. So in other words, this piece of rock got smashed, pushed vertically 90 degrees from its original position, and then thrown up thousands of feet from where it had originally been, and then eroded away to leave the island that we see today. How did these things happen? Was this something that happened over millions of years very slowly? And if so, where did the forces come? The point I was making originally was that the plains, if you're talking about moving continents and then a resistance, now let's look at lifting the mountains. Let's take the Rocky Mountains. People are familiar with those. At the size, they go up to about 15,000 feet. Upthrust mountains, you look at the very top, they were about 10,000 feet under the ocean at one time. So you're doing a total differential vertical movement of around 25,000 feet, not to mention that you're distorting and pushing this rock. Now calculate the mass of the Rocky Mountains and the amount of energy to raise it by 25,000 feet. And you come up with a pretty big number. This is energy. Once again, you would have to take a force coming from the side, and it would have to continue to push and push and push until this rock was elevated by 25,000 feet. Not just a little rock, we're talking mountain ranges that span from one pole, the North Pole, to the South Pole, underwater. And so there's another good question. Why do the mountain ranges all seem to happen in the same spot? Well, let's go back and take a look at what's really happening. There's another experiment, kind of a thought experiment, that I use when some of the hardcore, die-hard plate tectonics people. I say, okay, pretend that there is a force. I said, let's pretend there is one. And let's just look at what would happen. So let's get some of the biggest earth-moving bulldozers. Let's create bulldozers that are continental in size. These have blades that are, maybe 500 miles long and 200 miles deep. And we put them side by side. These are our bulldozers, and we have power. We can pour diesel fuel into these till the cows come home. And we're going to push on this one side of the plate, and we're going to see what happens to the plate. Okay, and now we have our force. We can define a force, and we can put it there. And let's see what happens to the plate. Okay, now start pushing. All the bulldozers turn on, and they start pushing and pushing against the plate tectonic in one direction. And, gee, guess what happens? All of the force, all of the distortion that happens in that location, it doesn't happen thousands of miles inland where the mountain ranges are. It doesn't push the plate at all. The plate just sits there. All it does is distort the earth where we have our bulldozers. In other words, the mountain ranges that you see in the center of a continent could not possibly have been built by plate tectonics. Because even if you could define a force, a source of energy, which we did with our massive Earth-sized bulldozers, they wouldn't cause the mountains 2,000-3,000 miles away to form. So, okay, now you're getting at the heart. Now you're getting at the heart of the issue. So the question is, so how did the mountains form? And the second question is, why did they always seem to build up at the same place? You can look at, in fact, I'm looking right now at a fossil. It's called Orthoceras, and it's I know everybody has seen these. They're from about 400 million years ago. They're kind of a cone-shaped mollusk fossil, lived a little sea animal, lived about 400 million years ago, I am told, before the ages of the dinosaurs. And these little sea animals are encrusted. You can find them all over the earth. But the point is that now these particular little sea animals you can find at the top part of any mountain range, encrusted in the layers of especially limestone and other types of sedimentary rock where the little animal died and was encrusted and formed a fossil. And you can find these all over the place, all over the world. But the point is that now they formed in an ocean 10,000 feet deep, and now they're sitting at the top of a mountain. Okay, well, let's take a look at what really happens. Plate tectonics doesn't work. It's one of those fairy tale science theories that has permeated the textbooks, should have never been there. The one thing that does convince some people that plate tectonics does work is you can actually see plate movement. And that is true. You do see plate movement. It's slow. It's seemingly constant. You can see breaks in the earth where something over here is juxtapositioned and a certain plate has moved northwards or southwards, and the shear lines don't add up. They don't join anymore. So clearly things have moved. Things are moving. Why is that? That's because the earth is just now relaxing from major events that happened throughout its history. I would estimate that there were probably about 20 major mountain building epochs in the history of the world. And so then one has to ask the question, well, why don't we have mountains all over the place? Well, let's take a look at what happens when a large celestial object comes passing by Earth. And as I've said many times before, a lot of other things happen at the same time, because what we're dealing with here is not simply a big round planetary object. It's a big round planetary object moving through our solar system, and that in turn discharges the solar capacitor. So this object is hidden in a shroud, a massive shroud of coma of a comet. It has a water coma. There are hydrocarbons, nitrogen compounds. And this is the tortured Earth. You see the results of the passage of this. You see electrical discharges that have carved the Earth's surface as the electrical discharges moved across the Earth's surface. You can see that the Earth's atmosphere has changed. You can see that the Earth's ocean levels have changed. That's been bombarded by pollution, by nitrogen, by carbon-hydrogen compounds, oil, tar, burning as it comes into the atmosphere. So all of these things happening, but what I wanted to concentrate on tonight was simply the passage of one of these massive celestial objects. Okay, now let's go back and just look at something we're all familiar with, the moon. The moon puts a tidal wave, so to speak, in the Earth's ocean. We all know about the Earth's tides. It's something that is well known about, well understood. It's a differential force that occurs on Earth due to the moon. As we spin underneath the moon, the Earth spins around every 24 hours on its axis, and so relative to the moon's orbit, Earth spins pretty quickly. We spin in about one day. The moon moves around in its orbit around Earth about every 27 days. So relatively speaking, the moon is sitting pretty still relative to the Earth. So it's basically the Earth spinning on its axis every 24 hours. And what does the moon do? The gravitational field of the moon pulls harder on the near side, and it pulls less hard on the far side of the Earth, both of those causing a bulge in the Earth's oceans. So as that bulge tries to align with the moon, and the Earth spins around on its axis every 24 hours, you can see that the tide moves around the Earth every 24 hours. Actually, it comes and goes every 12 hours. You get the high tide, the low tide, the high tide, and the low tide, as the Earth spins around on its axis twice in one day. So at any rate, the point is that that's a tidal wave. That's a tide due to the moon, and it can be very much in a very high in places like the Bay of Fundy, up like in Maine. Those locations see a very high tide and a very low tide, whereas many of the equatorial region, the places in the equator, don't see that high a difference in the tides. In fact, there's a lot of people who've lived near the equator who don't really understand what tides are at all because they're not experienced with them. They mainly, the bigger tides occur at the higher latitudes. But at any rate, the point is that that tide also is set up in the Earth's surface. There's about a 1-inch tide compared to a 15-foot tide in the Earth's oceans. The 15-foot tide in the Earth's oceans compared to a 1-inch tidal wave in the Earth's physical surface that goes up and down every day. And that can also jar earthquakes, volcanoes. It can help keep the Earth moving, it's a very low vibrational mode, so to speak. But over time, sure, that can cause the Earth to move and eventually cause slippage along plate boundaries where there's a lot of tension, causing earthquakes, etc. So at any rate, the point is, what happens if a very large, now the moon is relatively small, has a low surface gravity, what if a big object comes by relatively quickly? What if a big object comes by relatively fast and relatively close? There are many factors involved in what are known as tidal waves. It's a term used in celestial mechanics. The tidal wave is a differential force, and it's very much smaller than the gravitational force itself. It's simply a differential force. It's just that the moon's gravity pulls a little bit harder when on the high side of the Earth that's closest to the moon, and a little less hard on the other side of the Earth. So it's a differential. It's the difference between the force at the center of the Earth and the force at the surface of the Earth. Okay, so the point is that the same occurs with tidal waves in the land masses of the Earth, in the crust and in the mantle. So what happens when a large celestial object comes cruising by Earth? First of all, as I said, we get all of the other effects, the comet tail, the flooding, the extraction of Earth's atmosphere in some cases, the changing of Earth's atmosphere, the pollution, the electrical effects, the volcanoes going off, earthquakes. Earth is a tortured place when this happens, and the end result is that these also coincide with mass extinctions and mountain building. When the gravitational wave passes through the surface of the Earth, is just like the moon's differential gravitational wave, but much bigger. It can be much bigger and it'll move much faster. So the end result is that you could have, let's imagine this now. I want to make one more point about the lunar tide that I was talking about, the tide that's set up in the Earth's ocean. And a lot of people don't understand this. At the Earth's equator, there's a 25,000-mile diameter of Earth, and the Earth spins about once every 24 hours, so that's about 1,000 miles per hour. The surface of the Earth around the equator is moving at around 1,000 miles an hour, so the tidal wave due to the moon is also moving at around 1,000 miles per hour. That's a very fast wave. That's a very fast-moving wave. The point is that as an object comes by the Earth and is moving fast and also more massive than the moon and comes by within a relatively close distance, the point is that the tidal wave set up in Earth's surface could be as much as, let's say, 50 to 100 feet high, moving at 1,000 miles an hour. You don't feel the 1-inch tidal wave that occurs every day, but you certainly would feel a 50 or 100-foot tidal wave as it rolled underneath you, and all of the earth disaster that would be going on, earthquakes. I know that the Colburn is very specific about talking about the earth opening up and swallowing people in many places. That's the kind of thing that would be happening. And eventually, as it rained, as the things settled down, the earth would fill in these cracks and no one would be any the wiser. But imagine a 50 or 100-foot land tidal wave rolling across the surface of the earth at about 1,000 miles per hour. It's a wave. It's just like a wave in the ocean. As that wave of energy moves across the surface of the earth, guess what's going to happen when that wave of energy hits an existing mountain range? The wave is going to stop. It's going to that energy is going to be collected where existing mountain ranges already are sitting in the path of this wave. The wave might be coming in, say, from the north or the east or the west or the south. It could be coming in from just about any direction based on the passage of this large celestial object. So the point is that when that wave hits the existing mountain range, that's where most of the energy is going to be expended, and whoom, more mountain building. And it happens very quickly. The ancients are very specific. The ones that lived through these events to tell about it, they're very specific that mountain building occurred. The mountains that were there after the event were different than the ones that were there before. And as I said, there were probably at least 50, there were probably at least 20 major mountain building events on Earth, and possibly quite a few other large ones. So the Earth's surface is a very tortured surface. It's one, when you look at mountain ranges, especially when you look at the upthrust mountains, you see an Earth that has been tortured. It's been shattered. It's been that's where the energy comes to take something that's 10,000 feet below the ocean and throw it up 25,000 feet. That's the kind of energy source that you need to do this, the kind of dynamics that you see. Now you have an energy source. It's a gravitational wave set into the Earth's surface by a large passing comet nucleus. And now, let me just clarify that. The small comets, not all comets do this. We have not seen these kind of comets in the solar system for a long time. Venus is the last event that we know where there was recorded history of such an event. And Venus is slightly smaller than the Earth. It's hard to say what mountain addition went on when Venus passed by twice, in fact, about the number within the past 10,000 years. Another issue I want to talk about is glaciation. It's very interesting when you see the glaciated areas of the world right now. These are mini glaciers compared to the great glaciers of old that covered vast amounts of land, vast amounts of land of the earth. According to standard science, these just kind of magically all started on their own and marched out across the surface of the earth. And when they receded, they carved out valleys, they carved out mountain valleys, etc. But this is something that I've been working on lately. How long did it take a glacier to carve out a mountain valley? And the way they discuss it, the way I've seen it discussed in geology courses, in geology books, and in the information you get about the geological history of mountains, this is just kind of this big sheet of ice moved out and there was a valley. Well, no. There had to be ongoing process of snow, ice creation, and movement of, as the glaciers flow, just like water. You can see the glaciers that still exist in Alaska moving very slowly and carving out that valley. But these processes are recurring. In other words, they happen over and over and over again. The snow is built up and the glacier flows down that valley for possibly a million years, 100 million years. Who knows what the time frame for these processes might be. But the processes for glaciation and carving out these glaciated mountain ranges, they take a very long time. It's not something that happened just with one glaciation and all of a sudden there you are with a mountain range that's carved away. So, but the point is that the mountain ranges that we see in the world today have been formed, first of all, by uplift created during times when the Earth is under extreme stress due to passing large comets. That's when also the ice ages move in, because what happens? We move through that comet tail, we lose the sun for 20, 30, 40, 50 days at a time, and so we lose that energy input from the sun. Glaciers form, and it takes a very long time for the Earth to recover. That's where glaciation periods occur. So we know that there have been 4 to 5 major glaciation periods within the past of probably 10,000 years. So that means the passage of a large comet. And so we don't have the history because modern science refuses to acknowledge this or study it. Imagine where science books would be today if you broke down that barrier, got science and scientists to start looking at the data the way it should be. But as soon as you get data, you have a NASA scientist jump out of his chair and say, 4 billion years ago. Or I always have to joke because I say NASA and the other geologists and evolutionary biologists, etc., have a hat. And in the hat are a bunch of numbers. And so when they see something, they grab the hat and they pull out a number and they read it, and that goes into the textbook. And forever after, that's the age of whatever it might be. And so there's it's like pulling a rabbit out of a hat. And once it gets into the textbooks, once it's in the so-called respected journals, nobody can change it. Nobody can question it. So thus, the science of today, I remember there was someone that suggested one time that we get all the experts in the world together and get a vast computer system and have them put all the knowledge that they had in a computer system, and then we would call that a knowledge machine. Well, there's one little problem with science today. Just about everything taught in the universities regarding space science, regarding the history of Earth and the planets, regarding the geology of Earth, regarding the geology of the Moon, about 90% of it is incorrect. So it has to be revised, and not just a little bit revised, it has to be completely torn down and rebuilt, based on the fact that Earth has had a tortured past. All of the planets have had tortured pasts. Hope that gives you a little bit of a feeling for what I think about plate tectonics. And some of the reasons, these are things that people can understand. This is not, you don't need a PhD in geology to understand that there are no forces for plate tectonics to work. It makes a nice drawing in a textbook. You can do a pretty good artistic animation of it, but the reality is, the physics of it, it simply doesn't work. Okay, I'm about out of time here. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.